Are you sure you want to stay here? It looks creepy.
But Savannah, this is the House of Mystery. Let's see, the brochure says true crime, conspiracy, alternate history, all rooms right here in the house.
I don't know, which room is ours?
Yes, this may be our room. Oh, well, sorry, ma'am. Obviously, this is not our room.
Oh, here's our room. True crime.
You've now entered the House of Mystery on KKNW 1150 AM, Seattle. The best in true crime, conspiracy, and history with Al Warren and Kev Thompson.
By Maria Meyer, available on Amazon.
Welcome back to the House of Mystery on KKNW 1150 AM Seattle. I'm Al Warren, and in the cave is Kev Thompson.
Hey, Al, what's going on?
You know, it's the same old thing. Now, you know, this is typically the Trump-free zone. So, you know, of course, we don't talk about that.
Typically.
But today we are covering presidents, but we are covering the deaths of presidents and maybe some of the births and some of the weird things that's come along with them, not just how they run. We've got a great author with us and really, really good books, taking a lot of time for him to write them, I would guess. And he's done all sorts of things. Wow, I was just reading his resume, and that's another person that's going to make us feel like we're really not contributing to society.
Oh, wow. again?
So joining us now is all the way from the capital of the United States, Jersey, Louis Pecan. Thank you for being here.
Oh, thank you very much for having me, and thank you for that very nice introduction. Sure, that people are contributing to society.
Well, yeah. I mean, wow. I mean, you certainly, where does it start? How did you get into writing these books about the presidents, first of all?
Well, for me, it started about 10 years ago. And at the time, I wasn't interested in the presidents at all. I did like history, and it started pretty innocently. I have two little boys. My son Vincent is 13. My younger son Leonardo was 9. So at the time that my older son was a baby, we bought him a placemat with all of the presidents on it. I thought that it would be fun for a little kid to eat his food with a placemat of the presidents. I didn't think much of it. And one of my brothers came to visit, and he had claimed that he could name all the presidents in order, and I challenged him on it, and I looked at the placemat as he was doing it, and sure enough, he was able to name every president in order. And at the time, I wasn't able to do that, and it really struck me. It surprised me that my younger brother was able to do this, but it also really shocked me that there was some of the people that were presidents that I'd never heard of before, like Chester Arthur, Benjamin Harrison, two names that I really hadn't heard of before, So it really motivated me to learn more about the presidents. So I started reading voraciously, and I also started visiting some sites. At about the same time, again, my son was young, and we started taking road trips. I was struggling to come up with gifts to buy my parents, so I decided to take them on road trips around the country. So as you mentioned, I'm from New Jersey. So we took some local road trips, a couple states over to Virginia and to Ohio, and both states happened to be the two most popular states for presidential births. So just traveling to the states and visiting different sites, I started to gravitate towards presidential birthplaces. And I found some really interesting stories at these sites. And again, just as a visitor, not as a writer, but from going to the presidential birthplaces, it kind of dawned on me that there wasn't any books written just about the presidential birthplaces. And I was looking for one just to help in my travels. And that's where I really started digging in into the research. And it kind of dawned on me what a great book this would make. I started working on it. It took about 4 years to research and write. And then in 2012, that's when my first book was published, which is Where the Presidents Were Born, The History and Preservation of the Presidential Birthplaces.
Yeah, it's really, really interesting. I was going to say, too, I visited your website, and that's lewispecan.com. And you've got pictures, like so you can go to any of the presidents and click on a president. You should try that, Kevin. You'll have fun with this. So you can pick on, like, Thomas Jefferson, and up will come, you know, where he was born. And you've also got his grave site. And you've got a picture of Lewis in there, too. He's wearing shorts. He looks good in shorts.
Bit of summer.
Yeah. But I found that really interesting. I thought that was really kind of a cool idea for a website. I had no idea what to expect. Sounds kind of weird, but I just thought that was kind of cool. Did you find going to these places changed you in some way, or did you pick up something from the place where people were born or where they're buried now?
Yeah, I mean, many of these places I did tons of research before actually visiting, but I always found something more in being in the places. I get a lot out of just walking on the same grounds that presidents walked and being in the same space that historic events have happened. And also, there's just all, I'll find out things when I'm there that just didn't come up in my research. So yeah, it's, I mean, to me, it's very important to be at the places as that these events happen, and especially for my writing, I think it makes it much richer. So all of the pictures from my website are all photographs that I've taken or places that I've been to.
Yeah.
So they're all part of my personal travels.
And it's a write-off too, yeah. Right? So.
Yeah, exactly.
Boy, I'm I'm doing good today.
Show.
So now in some of the grave sets, I've been noticing people have actually attempted to rob some of the president's graves.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
How what are they looking for? Like the body itself? Like what's the big common goal for this?
Yeah, I mean, there's been varied reasons. There was an attempted grave robbery of George Washington's grave. An attempted skull robbery. Where a disgruntled gardener from Mount Vernon broke in to what's now called the old tomb of George Washington. It's not where he's buried now, but it was his previous tomb, which is also on the grounds. And he was a disgruntled gardener about 30 years after Washington had died, and Mount Vernon was owned by one of his descendants. So he was fired, and he decided to get back at the owner at the time and steal George Washington's skull. It turns out that the tomb was in such disarray where there was other bodies entombed in the same crypt that he stole a skull, but it wasn't George Washington's skull.
He got the wrong one.
Yeah, he got the wrong skull. So they found him the next day. So in that instance, it was just revenge, I guess. Years later, there was a plot to steal Abraham Lincoln's body. And that was carried out by a gang from Chicago. And they had done it, or they had plotted this, because their ace counterfeiter, a man named Benjamin Boyd, had been arrested and put in prison. So this gang came up with a plot to steal Lincoln's body and then hold it ransom for the release of their counterfeiter. and actually, the tomb at the time was so unsecure that it was it was relatively easy to break into the iron gates. And they actually got the coffin about 15 inches out of the sarcophagus. But it turns out that a couple of people that were involved in the plot were also informants for the Secret Service. So they were inside of the tomb, which is this grand Gilded Age sort of tomb. So they were inside of it, robbing the coffin. Meanwhile, there was the Secret Service was in another room within the tomb, just waiting for the right moment to pounce on them to arrest them. But if it wasn't for those two people that were informants, there was a good chance that they might have gotten away with it.
Wow.
There was also a plot. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Well, you say that it is so unsecure that they were able to break in, but who would imagine that you would want to actually break in and desecrate part of our history? And that may sound naive of me, but then again, I respect history. But wow, you know, you're going to break in and you're going to desecrate the grave of one of our ancestors?
Yeah. At the time, it actually wasn't that unbelievable, because this was in the 1870s, and there was a period where people were robbing graves for medical research, because the practice of using cadavers was illegal. So doctors weren't doing it themselves, but they were getting other people to rob these graves and then bring them the cadavers so they can use for research. So grave robbing definitely wasn't unheard of at the time. Stealing a president's body, meanwhile, I mean, that was pretty unique.
Yeah, that, I would say that's, you know, I understand Washington's skull. I mean, you could put it on your table and put a candle on it.
Right?
No, but it's not like they had eBay in 1870.
Yeah,
by letter.
You know, $1,000 or best offer.
Yeah. Well, didn't they try to transfuse the blood or something with lamb's blood on Washington or something?
Yeah, yeah. After after Washington died, just the whole final days of Washington were pretty grueling, as doctors had treated him. The first person to treat him was actually a man that wasn't a doctor, but he had treated Washington slaves. And one of the things that he was an expert was bleeding. So over the next couple of days, Washington was bled immensely, and then he finally he succumbed to his throat infection and he died. So shortly after he died, a couple hours later, another doctor appeared at the house. They had called several doctors, and it took them a while to actually get to Mount Vernon. So one doctor, a man named William Thornton, had appeared at the house a couple of hours after Washington had already died. But he wasn't ready to give up, though, and he had suggested that they do a tracheotomy on Washington, inflate his lungs artificially with air, and then to transfuse him with the blood of a lamb to bring him back to life, kind of like a Dr. Frankenstein type of plan. Hey. So the doctor, actually, one thing that he's better known as is an architect. And he was actually the architect for the U.S. Capitol building. So he wasn't like a quack or anything. I don't know about his medical background, but he did go on to fame as an architect.
Hey, now we're all chuckling, but that doesn't sound like such a bad idea. I mean, it sounds like something we would actually try today.
Well, this was 1799, so it was a different time, and definitely medical information wasn't quite as advanced as it is now.
Yeah, because
they mentioned that Washington was bled. I mean, that was really the first line of treatment for most of the presidents that had died up until Zachary Taylor, who had died in 1850. Almost every president was treated with bleeding at some point of their treatment. So there was kind of these like medieval types of practices of cupping and bleeding and blistering, enemas as part of their treatment.
Well, they still do that.
Yeah. I do that just on my own. Yeah. But but I mean, you know, most of what you just said, though, is stuff that we would do today. A tracheotomy, artificial inflation. I mean, that to me sounds like life support systems.
Yeah. I mean, except for the
bloodletting,
lamb's blood and the bleeding. I guess there was some advances that are similar to today, but a lot of the practices that were used were really are considered medieval nowadays. Especially later on, particularly with James Garfield and William McKinley, two presidents that were shot. Garfield 1881 and McKinley 1901, sterilization practices weren't used. So doctors wouldn't, like now, would be the first thing they do is just wash their hands. And they weren't doing that back then. And that's probably the reason that James Garfield had died, just from infection.
Yeah, he put his hands right in, didn't he? Searching for the bullet.
Yeah, many doctors did. The first doctors that treated him on the floor of the train station dug their hands into him looking for the bullet. And then every doctor that treated him would do the same thing. There's been modern medical historians that have proposed that if the doctors didn't do anything, because Garfield was shot, if the doctors just left the bullet in there and let him go sleep it off, that he probably would have survived. It was more of a medical trauma that killed him.
Yeah, wow. We had Fred Rosen on, who wrote that with James Garfield's great-great-grandson about they you know, put all their fingers in and were digging, and then they tried to do the metal detection or something, if I remember right.
Yeah. They had Alexander Graham Bell,
right,
who was a young inventor at the time. So he had invented a metal detector, and twice he tried to use it on Garfield. To find the bullet, because the doctors were just obsessed with finding the bullet, and that's the reason that they kept digging in him with their hands, and for the most part, without amnesia, they do these operations on him. Without anesthesia, I said amnesia.
Yeah.
That's so, okay.
Yeah.
I don't remember you saying that.
Yeah. Garfield probably wished that he had amnesia when they were doing the operations on him.
Yeah, it's just...
So they reached out to Alexander Graham Bell, a young inventor at the time, to use his metal detector to try to find the bullet. Twice it was unsuccessful. The first time he believed that he was making some last-minute some last-minute modifications to the metal detector, and he thinks that's what ended up caused it to malfunction when he actually used it on Garfield. And the second time, it could have been from metal coils in the mattress, which was a relatively new invention at the time that was just setting off the metal detector.
Wow.
Both times, that's all.
That's a crazy story, that one. Okay. Now, Kevin, here's a tough one for you. Who was president for just one day?
Oh, wow.
Oh, you're not going to win this
one. I'm not.
Be a shame. Ding, ding.
Where's
shame?
Where's the Jeopardy music?
Well, that's...
Don't know.
David Rice Acheson.
Acheson, Kansas is named after him.
So now, why was he just in for one day? Like, what happened? That's part I didn't even know about till now.
Well, maybe Trump fired him like Scaramucci.
Scaramucci lasted 9 more days.
Yeah.
This is more, I put this in a section towards the end called Almost Presidents. Part of it, I think there was just some fascinating stories about several individuals that had some claim to being president of the American territories. David Rice Acheson is some of that is almost like mythology a little bit, where he was president for one day. And the story is when Zachary Taylor was inaugurated. He was supposed to be inaugurated on a Sunday. He was supposed to be sworn in on a Sunday. But he was very devout, and he decided that he wanted to wait until Monday.
Sure.
So
I can understand that.
Yeah. So the line of succession would have gone down. So during that day, there are some people that argue that there was no president that day. So James K. Polk was leaving the office. Zachary Taylor was coming into the office. So the next line of succession would have been the vice president, but the vice president also didn't get sworn in on that Sunday. So he also waited to Monday. So then the next person in the line of succession was the
House of Representatives.
Yeah, it went to the pro tempore of the Senate at the time. I think that the lineage has changed since then. But most people believe that even without being sworn in, that Zachary Taylor was president. But still, it kind of makes for a fun little story. But David Rice Acheson is listed on the congressional website as president for a day, and his grave in Plattsburgh, Missouri, has a large plaque in front of it that reads "President for a Day." There's a large statue up in the town. So the town really embraced it. Later in life, David Rice Acheson did too. He kind of joked around and he said that that he was up late the night before, so he slept most of the day of his one-day presidency. And he also called it the most honest administration in history.
Well, yeah, you're right. You're right. Almost sounds like a lottery winner, you know. I can be president for a day.
Yeah.
What would I do?
You know, sleep for the day sounds good.
Yeah, I'm going to sleep until when I want to wake up.
Yeah. Yeah.
Can't do much damage that way.
No. Yeah, better not. Now, conspiracy surrounding deaths. What are some of the wildest conspiracies that you've heard?
Well, the one that's probably the most wild conspiracy, which is pretty interesting because today is the anniversary of his death, August 2nd, is Warren G. Harding. He had died. He had taken he was campaigning for his next election it was 1824 election. He started to do some campaigning in 1823, and he took a train ride or a journey throughout the country, and even went into Alaska, which is the first president that ever went into Alaskan territories, and he called it his voyage of understanding, where he was basically speaking directly to the people, making stump speeches along the way, and doing photo ops in fields in Kansas and with local groups. So he had had some medical issues along the trip, and even at one point he was on a boat coming from Alaska, and he woke up in the middle of the night and had some crabs and butter, and he developed some pains after that they thought had been related to the midnight crabs. So he canceled some of his speeches on the West Coast and checked into a hotel, the Plaza Hotel in San Francisco. And by all accounts, he was getting better after a couple of days of rest. And on August 2nd, his wife was reading to him from the newspapers, and all of a sudden he had an attack, and then he recovered slightly, but then just moments later he had another attack and he died. So the country was in shock. He was really generally healthy, although he had some medical issues on the trip. There was nothing that looked like it would have been fatal. And right away, there were some doubts about who was in the room at the time, what time he died, what was what actually happened in the room when he died. And there was a New York Times reporter that, like, the very next day started to notice these inconsistencies with all the people that were in the room with them and their different versions of the story. So there was some conspiracy theories that his wife Florence had actually killed him, that she knew about these brewing scandals like Teapot Dome, which came out after his death. He was having some liaisons with other women. So there was some speculation.
The hell you say.
there was even some conjecture that maybe his doctor had killed him inadvertently. There was a man named Dr. Sawyer, which was his small-town doctor back in Ohio, and he brought him to the White House with him. And he had been treating him with these strange injections he was giving him. It was like these stimulants. Later historians weren't able to really figure out exactly what was in those stimulants. But there was some speculation that maybe those stimulants are what ended up killing him. There's been a lot of conspiracy theories about what had killed him. Even the cause of death has been doubted, whether it was a stroke or whether it was a heart attack. But I think as far as conspiracy theories, probably Warren G. Harding does take the cake, although there have been several others, too.
And the cake was poisoned.
Yep, it might have been poisoned, yeah. And there was also another one that there was speculation that he had died from arsenic poisoning was Zachary Taylor. Zachary Taylor had died in July of 1850, and what happened was that he went to a dedication at Washington Monument on July 4th, and he had some unwashed cherries and some milk with ice, and then after that he got sick, and then he died several days later. So medical historians have also speculated on what disease might have killed him. About 140 years later, there was a woman that was doing research on Zachary Taylor for a biography, and she had researched the symptoms of his death, and she believed that he died from arsenic poisoning. So she was so convinced of the arsenic poisoning and also managed to convince the descendants of Zachary Taylor, where in 1991 they exhumed his body and they took fingernails and hair and they did some lab testing on it to see if he had died from arsenic poisoning.
Correct.
Excuse me?
And did
no, it? I was saying correct.
But what they found is that it wasn't a high level of arsenic in his blood or in his tissue.
Oh.
So that had that theory.
Oh, too bad.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I like a little bit of fun. That's really interesting. I was noticing here that you spoke too at an international conference, U.S. presidents and Russian rulers. At the Russian Academy of Science in Moscow.
Yeah.
How was that?
Yeah, that was, it was an incredible experience. I was invited to speak there. My first book came out in 2012. My second book came out in 2016. So this was in between the two. I was invited to speak at this conference, which took place last June. So it was put on by a Russian academic and a professor from Stanford University, and it was the speakers that were invited were some of the best presidential historians in the country. There was professors from Yale and from Brown and from Harvard and from Cambridge in the UK. But what happened was the Russian academic is also a fan of presidential sites. He's made several trips to the U.S., and he's visited many of the presidential birthplaces and many of the presidential graves and other homes and presidential libraries. And at one of these sites, he picked up my book. So when they were doing the invitations for the speakers, he had specifically asked for me, for the author of Where the Presidents Were Born.
Wow, that's pretty. How did you like it? And how was Moscow? I think that's fascinating.
That's an
honor. It was Beautiful city. I could say everyone was really friendly there. We spent 3 days at the conference in Moscow. One of the things that I did when I was interested in seeing, we didn't get too much time to tour around Moscow, but I arrived one day early, so one of the things that I wanted to do was see Lenin's tomb. So I got to see that, and I got to see Red Square. And then after Moscow, the whole group of us took a train ride to St. Petersburg, and we got a 3-day tour of St. Petersburg.
Wow.
It was a great experience, and getting to meet and speak with the other presidential historians was really fantastic, and it was a very warm welcome from everyone that we met in Russia. And we also had at the Hermitage Museum, and everyone was just very welcoming to us.
Now, Al,
what?
Do you realize what you've just done?
I've been in collusion with the Russians.
Yes. Now we're going to have to edit all of this out because now he's in collusion with the Russians.
Yeah, but you know, he wasn't working for Trump, so. Or were you?
It doesn't matter.
Wow.
Now I've got a question, and this is going to sound a little bit sappy. When you were exploring the early presidents, did you discover that they had all come from such humble beginnings? Like George Washington, Abraham Lincoln, you know, we have these grandiose ideas of who they are. But when you look at where they're born and where they grew up, I mean, was it humble?
You know, most of the early presidents weren't from humble beginnings. Like George Washington, I think, I'm not sure where he ranks now, but I know recently he was still considered the richest president. Now, a lot of that wealth was gathered later in life, but even where he was born, it was a relatively large plantation home. The home is no longer there. But one thing that I found is that most of the early presidents, which came from Virginia, like Washington, Jefferson, Monroe and Madison, they came from, I mean, they later gathered a lot of wealth, but they came from relatively modest beginnings. The first president that really came from very poor beginnings was Andrew Jackson. He was the first born in a log cabin. His father had died just days before he was born, so he was kind of shuffled between different aunt and uncle's log cabins. And even his birthplace isn't quite 100% known because it might have been at either one of his aunt's homes. And one is on one side of the North Carolina-South Carolina border. The other one is on the other side. So it makes for a pretty interesting story exactly where Andrew Jackson.
So did he have a copy of his birth certificate?
Yeah, no, he didn't have a copy of it.
From Hawaii.
See you later in life. But one thing that I did find, too, is that Abraham Lincoln is really known as coming from dirt poor beginnings. But his family, like the plot that he was born on, was a 200-acre plot. So it was a relatively big piece of land. It wasn't a very prosperous farm, what they found when they tried to farm it, that the land wasn't really great for it. But it wasn't quite the dirt poor beginnings that he's really known for.
Mm. Wow.
Well, the reason I ask that is because so many people tell their children, and you know, we've heard this for generations, someday you can grow up to be president, but it seems like that's a more difficult dream as we go on.
Yeah. Well, it became. And probably around the time of Andrew Jackson, it really became almost like a campaign slogan. William Henry Harrison really used it as a campaign slogan. He had his log cabin and hard cider campaign to insinuate that he came from very humble log cabin beginnings. Meanwhile, mm-hmm. He was born at this mansion in Virginia. So it really kind of turned into like a campaign slogan. I mean, many of them did come from humble beginnings. Between Jackson and James Garfield, who was the last president born in a log cabin, there was many of those presidents during that period that were that did come from log cabins. But also, there was many presidents that really tried to use that humble beginnings slogan during their campaigning.
Yes, unlike our president now. But
yeah. Yeah, I don't think he can get away with it.
No. But now, that brings me to Thomas Jefferson. Why is he the only one whose home is portrayed on a coin?
That's a real good question. I don't know if I have the answer for that. Because Monticello is on nickel.
Yes.
Why that's the only home? It might be because it's the most recognizable of homes. I mean, Mount Vernon is certainly up there with the most famous of homes. But I think from looking at the two, probably most people would recognize Monticello as Jefferson's home as opposed to Mount Vernon. But you know what, though? Actually, I know on the most recent round of pennies that they put out, they have the log cabin on there for Abraham Lincoln because they've got several designs.
But it's almost like an afterthought. You know, because we tend to recognize our presidents on our money. And that's because, you know, we have loved them for, you know, one reason or another. So why haven't we recognized, you know, I know we have, the 50-cent piece. Why haven't we recognized JFK? Because he is like supposedly the epitome of what a president should be. Mm-hmm. Why haven't we put him on paper money?
I think, I'm just speculating, but many of the more recent presidents aren't on money. I mean, they have the dollar coins. So every president is going to get his coin. Although I think by the time they got to JFK, they realized that these dollars were just being stockpiled in the mint and people weren't spending them.
Yes.
They stopped making as many as they used to. Now they're really almost just for collectors. They make a very limited amount. But it's possible that I think just maybe with the recent presidents, people are more partisan and it's a little more difficult to agree on which presidents to put on currency. Many of the earlier presidents kind of transcended any sort of partisanship, so there wouldn't be any question about whether Washington or Lincoln or Jefferson deserved to be on currency.
Right.
And now we're seeing where some of that is being revisited, like Andrew Jackson was on the $20 bill, and now there's plans to change that design with Harriet Tubman being put on the bill.
Now, I respectfully, and let me be very careful with this, respectfully, I take issue with that.
Okay.
No problem with Harriet Tubman. I understand, and I respect very much what she did and what she stood for. But why would we put Harriet Tubman in front of vice presidents? Why don't we have any vice presidents recognized on our money?
Yeah.
We have
why don't we have Mick Jagger?
Mick Jagger. Stop.
Well,
we
have Thomas Jefferson, who was also vice president, is on the $2 bill.
I'm not buying that. I'm not buying that. I'm calling shenanigans.
Well, I Who I don't know. Who's to say?
Because vice presidents do a very important job.
Even vice presidents need love, too?
Yeah, that's true.
Well, I feel that they need recognition.
Okay.
So why don't we put them on some type of money before we put an activist?
I think people forget. And just as when we look back at Washington, Jefferson, Lincoln, all the way, we don't really think of them as the party and all the things that they've done. The ones that are more recent, we think of that. It's closer. so comes with their baggage. Like, for instance, Trump right now, in 200-300 years from now, when they're talking about it, most of the baggage will be gone, right? And they won't be talking about it as much. I think people just forget. And vice presidents are more forgetful than the presidents.
Because
right now, how many vice presidents can you name from way back then? Not just the recent ones. But yet you still know most of the presidents. So it's probably why. Just what's in your mind, you know?
Yeah. But I also agree that Harry Tubman is a great choice for the bill. So I've got no problem with that.
Yeah. Oh, I'm not disagreeing. I'm just saying that, you know, we recognize our presidents on our currency. However, the vice presidents kind of get shafted.
Yeah.
Well,
they probably have stamps.
Yeah.
There you go. We'll put them on stamps.
Nobody uses them anymore, but that's okay.
Well, I'm going to start stamping my email.
Yeah, you get on that. So, but anyway, I thought that's pretty impressive anyway, being over in Moscow and actually meeting people and stuff. And
Yeah, that was a really great experience. And I really, what I did, I presented a paper on the history of presidential birthplace commemoration. So my book really takes like one birthplace at a time, but what I decided to do was kind of take a step back and just look at, like, in general, how we started to recognize these birthplaces over time. So it was pretty interesting to look at my own material in a different angle for the paper.
Yeah. Whose grave site is probably the most popular?
I'm pretty sure it's Abraham Lincoln's. I forget the exact number. You know what? I'm sorry. I'm going to take that back. It's JFK's, which is at Arlington Cemetery. So I don't know the current numbers, but I know in the first 3 years, there was like 16 million people that visited the site.
Wow.
And that might have been before the current infrastructure of now there is like a little trolley that you take throughout Arlington Cemetery when you go visit that stops at Kennedy's grave site. Every time that I've been there's always a massive crowd there. So you're definitely right. You mentioned Kennedy earlier. He does have this incredible appeal. So even to this day, I'm pretty sure that's the most visited. And then Lincoln would probably be second.
Yeah, and they seem to be the ones that, because even the war presidents, we don't hear as much about. You know, it's something about Kennedy and Lincoln that stick out.
Yeah, like you would think FDR would be the most visited.
Yeah, I mean, well, FDR kind of started a whole new pattern because he was buried at his presidential library. So there are the visitors at the presidential library that also visit the graves, so they have to kind of check those numbers to see where they overlap. But pretty much ever since FDR, almost every president has been buried at their presidential library. Kennedy's library obviously wasn't completed when he died. And LBJ is buried at his home, not his presidential library. But I believe every other president that has died since FDR is buried at their presidential library. It's kind of become like the new standard now.
Now, early in the interview, you kind of alarmed me as far as people robbing graves. Have they started providing security since then?
I mean, many of the graves after those attempted robbings did have security. That was almost round the clock. Like when Grant died, there was 24-hour security at his temporary tomb, which was in New York City, before the permanent one was built. So there was this time when graves had 24-hour security, especially while larger, more secure tombs were being built. Now I'm sure there's a lot of surveillance. You don't really see the guards at the tombs as much, but you're probably being watched closer than ever, even when there was guards at the tombs.
When you say, I noticed you've got written critical death information. What does that mean in your book? What can people get?
Well, what I the way that I structured both of my books is that I they're meant to be, if someone wants to read them all the way through, or if they just decide to read one chapter at a time, maybe if they're going to visit one of the presidential graves, and they want to get just information on their president to kind of prepare them for the visit. And also, I should mention too, I also wrote about where they died, like the location of where they died, where they had their funeral, where they were buried. 15 presidents were reinterred over the years, so I wrote about any of those sites that were specific to the presidential death or that were pertinent to the presidential death. But what I put in that critical information is more just like a summary before getting into the chapter. So I have the date that they died, the cause of death, the age in years and days. I also have their last words. So many of the presidential last words are pretty interesting.
What was the most interesting? Which one sticks with you the most?
Probably Millard Fillmore, that he said. the nourishment is palatable. Very,
what?
Very prompt last word.
The nourishment is palatable, which means this is edible.
Yeah, this is edible.
McDonald's drive-thru.
Now, George Washington's last words were interesting. The service are not that interesting because his last words were "tis well." But what I did is that I dug back more into the story for that. And what he was speaking to his assistant or to his personal secretary, a man named Tobias Lear. And Washington knew he was going to die. He knew he was running out of time. And his biggest concern in those last hours was being put in the crypt while he was still alive. So he was explaining, telling his personal secretary, Tobias Lear, don't let them put me in the crypt until 3 days after I'm dead. And Tobias Lear really, by all accounts, he really loved Washington and I'm sure was in denial. So he didn't answer him at first. And then Washington insisted, he was so concerned about being buried alive that he insisted, do you understand me? And then finally Lear said, yes, I do. And then Washington said, tis well, which was kind of like saying okay in 1799. So those were his last words, which I think are some of the most interesting just with the backstory. Also, I tried to really go into the primary sources doing my research, like diaries, firsthand accounts, newspaper articles. And one thing that I found that was interesting is so often you hear of John Adams' last words in saying Thomas Jefferson survived, because him and Jefferson died on the same day, 1826, 50 years after the signing of the Declaration of Independence. But just from going through the resources, or from the primary resources, I found that he did speak after that. He did say Thomas Jefferson survived, and even in the John Adams miniseries they did on HBO, after he said that, he closed his eyes and died. But he actually did speak after that.
Was it a contest?
Excuse me?
I mean, was it a contest?
A contest? Oh, no. Well, they were, I mean, they were just because they were the really two last members of the independence of the Declaration of Independence generation. And they had, I mean, they were so far away that it took several days for the news to travel back and forth. So this was Adams' way of saying, even though I'm gone, that that the legacy of the Declaration of Independence still lives on. Thomas Jefferson survives. But his actual last words were speaking to his granddaughter. And he was in pain, and he just asked his granddaughter, he said, help me, child, help me. It was just interesting. And it kind of shows, like these men, you're right, we kind of put them on pedestals, we put them on Mount Rushmore. But in these final hours, you really see that these were regular people, and they were in pain many times. So I thought that was pretty interesting, kind of stripped down past the mythology.
Yeah, yeah. And what have you got planned next? Now that you've done births and deaths, president's sex lives or what?
Yeah.
Oh, no, no.
Well, that would be a whole series of books. That would
yes.
Be. Yeah, yeah, ghost stories of the president. And they're actually, again, but there was one person that went to go visit Mount Vernon years after Washington died, and he stayed in the room that Washington died in. It was from Quincy, Massachusetts. And he had he left an account where he claimed to have been visited by Washington's spirit during the night. So there are those ghost stories with the president.
Oh, now you can't just drop me a Ghostbuster off at the corner. What did his spirit say?
But that's not what I'm working on for my next book, though.
Oh.
Yeah, you're, that's it.
You're not answering the question. What did he say?
Oh, I'm sorry. What did he say? Oh, yeah, no, he didn't yes. make an account of exactly what Washington said to him. But it was interesting because when the owner of Mount Vernon at the time was showing in his room, he even said, he said, some people have been counseled by General Washington in the middle of the night. And then later he left this account of Washington coming to visit him. But I don't think he left the exact words of the conversation, though.
I know what he said. I know what he said.
What was that, Al?
He said, even vice presidents need love, too.
There you go.
See? Well, this is fascinating. I can't believe the amount of work you've done. There's got to be exhaustive research and lots of traveling. That's just amazing. I think that we thank you for all the work because these are great books that even the Russians appreciate. And that's important in these times.
Be careful.
Now, how do people get a hold of you? If they have some information, maybe give out your website and other information.
Sure. Well, my website is www.louispicone.com, and that's LOUISPICONE. And as you mentioned, and thank you very much, I have pictures of sites that I've visited of all of the presidents from Washington through Trump. So they can reach me from there. I'm also on Twitter. They can look for Louis Picone. And I'm on Facebook, and my author page is Louis L. Picone. Author. So if you search for Louis Picone, you can find me on those social media platforms.
That's great. Well, I really appreciate it. Our guest today has been the President is Dead, Louis L. Picone. Thank you for being on the show.
Well, Louis?
Well, thank you very much. This has been a great conversation. I appreciate it.
Well, I have one last question.
Okay.
If we create a $1,000 bill, what president is going to be on it?
I think one's on there already. I'm pretty sure it's Grover Cleveland that's on the $1,000 bill.
Yeah. Kevin's never been paid that much, so.
Yeah,
never.
Never seen one in person, but yeah.
No.
And I think it's perfectly justified being the only president born in my home state of New Jersey. So I'm 100% supportive of Grover Cleveland on the $1,000 bill and remaining there.
Well, you guys love Chris Christie. Or, I mean,
yeah, what? Well, that'd be a big ass bill.
On that note, we sign up.
To find out more about our show, guests, or listen to a previous show, visit our website at www.somethingweirdmedia.com.
The mission has been completed.
The end!
By George, he's got it! It is the end!
I'll see you.
If you're lying to me, I'll be back.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.